From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. President Obama, in the closing days of his administration, has been faced with a number of challenges, including a raucous meeting at the United Nations Security Council on Tuesday over the issue of Israel and Palestine. Priyanka Shankar reports from the United Nations.
The construction and expansion of illegal settlements in the West Bank, including East Jerusalem, as well as ongoing acts of violence and terrorism, have hampered negotiations for a two-state solution. The UN Special Coordinator for the Middle East Peace Process, Nikolai Mladenov, was speaking via video teleconference from Jerusalem to members of the Security Council. Recalling a recent terrorist attack that killed four Israelis and injured 17 more in the city, Mr. Mladenov described it as an act of cowardice and deplored that some Palestinian factions and leaders praised and glorified it while others remained silent. Israeli and Palestinian leaders have a responsibility to reduce tensions and provide a political horizon for their people, he said. The global community has a responsibility to prevent the Israeli-Palestinian conflict from being engulfed in the middle of violent extremism and religious turmoil that is sweeping across the Middle East, Mr. Mladenov said. Priyanka Shankar, United Nations.
The UN Special Coordinator spoke at the UN Security Council on Tuesday and said the following.
Members of the Security Council, I report to you today in the aftermath of the appalling truck ramming attack on January the 8th that killed four Israelis and injured 17 more in Jerusalem. Such attacks can never be justified and must be universally condemned. This act of cowardice was neither courageous nor heroic. Such terrorist attacks must be unequivocally condemned by all. It is regrettable that some Palestinian factions and leaders have chosen to praise this attack, to glorify it, or simply to ignore it. Mr. President, despite the relative tranquility of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict compared to developments in the region, the specter of violence is always near. Leaders on all sides have a responsibility to reduce tensions and provide a political horizon to their people. Most importantly, we all have a responsibility to prevent this conflict from being engulfed in the nexus of violent extremism and religious turmoil that is sweeping across the Middle East. Mr. President, in the first briefing to the Security Council for 2017, I would like to begin by honoring the critical efforts of the UN country team here on the ground. The UN agencies, funds and programs who work in a challenging security and political environment deserve our full support and recognition. Every day, the United Nations provides free basic education to over 300,000 students in 350 schools, family health services to almost 1.7 million Palestinians in 64 health centers. Every month, we deliver an average of 780,000 liters of fuel to sustain health, water and sanitation in municipal services. Every quarter, the UN provides food assistance to 1 million Palestine refugees in Gaza and the West Bank. Yet we also plan for the future. The United Nations in Palestine implements programs that will bring about sustainable solutions to the economic challenges facing Palestinian households. UN programs have supported the Palestinian government in the creation of approximately 14,000 businesses and 45,000 jobs for people who were previously reliant on humanitarian assistance. We help strengthen Palestinian institutions and prepare them for the future. The UN facilitates emergency preparedness and regional disaster risk cooperation between Jordanian, Israeli, and Palestinian emergency authorities. The services that we provide to Palestinians touch thousands of lives across the West Bank and Gaza. This vital work would have been impossible without the cooperation and support of both Israeli and Palestinian authorities and our counterparts. On behalf of the teams here on the ground, I would like to thank the Security Council and all member states for your invaluable and continuing support. Mr. President, in this council, I have repeatedly warned that failure by leaders on both sides to reverse the current negative trajectory will ensure that Israelis and Palestinians continue to live as prisoners of fear, trapped in a perpetual cycle of conflict. On December 23rd, the Security Council adopted Resolution 2334. It reiterated some of the key obstacles to achieving a negotiated two-state solution that were also identified in the July 2016 report of the Middle East Quartet, namely the construction and expansion of illegal settlements, continued acts of violence and terrorism, and incitement. The international community has clearly said that both sides must do their part in creating the necessary conditions to launch final status direct negotiations. It has called on Israel to demonstrate its commitment to the two-state solution by ceasing settlement activities and by implementing policy shifts consistent with prior agreements. It has called on the Palestinian leadership to denounce and to demonstrate their commitment to a peaceful two-state solution, and to clearly condemn all acts of terrorism by taking significant steps to curb incitement. Such steps by both sides would have a powerful and positive impact on the prospect for peace. The Middle East Quartet has been calling for such steps, a call that the Security Council and the international community has now welcomed. In the aftermath of the vote, emotions on the ground have been heightened. Calls have been made for the annexation of parts or the whole of Area C. Such divisive positions risk destroying the prospects for peace. All stakeholders must avoid any unilateral action that would prejudge a negotiated final status solution. Mr. President, last weekend, France hosted over 70 countries and international organizations in Paris, not to impose conditions on Israelis and Palestinians, but to reaffirm our collective support for the two-state solution and our readiness to support both parties in returning to meaningful negotiations. In particular, I note with appreciation the participants' welcoming of the quartet recommendations. While these political developments were unfolding abroad, important events were taking place here on the ground. After a relative lull during the reporting period, Israel conducted 24 demolitions, resulting in the displacement of 167 persons in the West Bank, including East Jerusalem. Yesterday, the Israeli Defense Forces fatally shot a 17-year-old Palestinian during clashes near Bethlehem. I reiterate that live fire should be used only as a last resort in situations of imminent threat of death or serious injury. Such incidents where use of force has resulted in death or injury must be properly investigated. Turning to internal Palestinian developments, the reported revocation in September of the parliamentary immunity of five Fatah bloc members in the Palestinian Legislative Council renewed debate about the legality of the decision to lift parliamentary immunity in the absence of regular PLC meetings. Palestine has come a long way in its path to building state institutions. Safeguarding their independence and checks and balances is vital to maintaining the public's trust. Much-needed preparations have begun on holding a regular session of the Palestinian National Council, which was last convened some 2 decades ago. I encourage all factions to seize this opportunity to achieve genuine reconciliation on the basis of the Palestine Liberation Organization's principles. Russia's recent initiative in Moscow, which provided a forum for Palestinian factions to hold open discussions, is also a welcome effort in this direction. Meanwhile, I remain greatly concerned by the increasing tensions in Gaza, exacerbated by the continued closures and the protracted humanitarian and development situation there. I'm particularly concerned by Hamas's crackdown on recent peaceful protests after 2 million Palestinians were left with just a couple of hours of electricity per day in the middle of winter. The right to freedom of expression, peaceful protest, and assembly in Gaza must be respected fully by all. While the immediate electricity crisis has been averted, thanks to the generous and timely support of the state of Qatar, the responsible authorities must find a suitable long-term solution to resolve the chronic electricity shortage. The United Nations is working to support such efforts. Against this backdrop, there have also been some positive developments. Israel has increased the entry of critical construction materials over the past weeks for Gaza. However, donor funds for shelter remain critically low. The current $300 million reconstruction gap is far too large, less than half of the $3.5 billion that were committed 2.5 years ago at the Cairo-Gaza Pledging Conference have been disbursed. Mr. President, turning to Lebanon, the formation of a government on 18th of December last year was very positive. It sustained the momentum for the appointment of Saad Hariri as Prime Minister on November 3rd and the election of President Aoun on the 31st of October. The President visited Saudi Arabia in early January at the invitation of King Salman. This visit paves the way for a new engagement and support for Lebanon's stability and security. Both sides have described the meeting as successful and as opening a new page. The government in Lebanon has outlined its priorities and vision for the country, reflecting its determination to tackle the country's urgent challenges. These moves signal cautious optimism and the potential for consolidating Lebanese institutions. Meanwhile, the Lebanese armed forces successfully foiled an attack and arrested 11 members of a terrorist cell in Tripoli that was linked to ISIS and the Nusra Front. Meanwhile, on the Golan, the situation in the Syrian Arab Republic has continued to affect significantly the Yondof area of operation. The ceasefire between Israel and the Syrian Arab Republic generally has been maintained, albeit in a highly volatile security environment. The Secretary General calls on all parties to prevent tensions or their escalation and to strictly abide by international law, in particular in respect of the territorial integrity and sovereignty of all countries in the region. Both Israel and the Syrian Arab Republic have stated their continued commitment to the disengagement of forces agreement. The full return of UNDOF to the area of separation remains a priority for the mission. Mr. President, the long, bloody history of the Arab-Palestinian conflict has offered us many lessons, some of which we have learned, but too many we have not. One lesson that we should all have learned by now is that opportunities to advance peace are rare and must be seized. Making the necessary compromises will never be easy. In recent weeks, the international community has expressed its continued commitment to the two-state solution. But resolutions and communiques alone will not achieve a just and lasting peace. What is required is action, first and foremost by the parties themselves. The United Nations remains committed to supporting Israelis and Palestinians on the difficult road ahead. Thank you.
Mladenov's comments were replied to by Palestine's permanent representative to the United Nations, Riyad Mansour. He spoke outside the council chambers at a press encounter Tuesday.
The Security Council just concluded its open debate during the course of the whole day regarding two important things, Resolution 2334 and its implementation, and also the momentum as it was reflected by the meeting, the international conference that took place last Sunday in Paris. 44 speakers took the floor, and we are grateful for the strong sentiment that was reflected in the debate, demanding the implementation of Security Council Resolution 2334. And in my statement, I emphasized that it is the responsibility of the Security Council, each and every member, to do whatever they can. It is their obligation, it is their responsibility under the chapter to implement Resolution 2334. And also, we expect the Secretary General to prepare his report according to the mandate given to him in the Security Council resolution, and this report to be, of course, in writing and to be one of the documents of the United Nations and the Security Council about the implementation of the Security Council resolution 2334. In this regard, we emphasized also the collective responsibility of members of the Security Council and the international community to be very vigilant in making sure that there is differentiation between Israeli proper and the occupied territory in terms of dealings with states, agencies, companies with Israel and occupied territory. I can say that the debate was a good one, but the proof is in the pudding in terms of the will in the Security Council to see that this resolution to be implemented. I believe that we cannot mend international law to accommodate the Israelis occupying power. It is the occupying power that is violating the law, and it has to abide by the will of the Security Council, the resolution, the charter, and international law. And we are looking forward for the will of the international community to bring Israel into compliance. If there are questions, I'll be happy to entertain them. Yes.
Thanks a lot. Thank you very much. I'm sure that you saw UK Prime Minister Theresa May. She ended up criticizing John Kerry's speech after the resolution, the abstention. And I just wondered, what did you make of that? What do you make of the politics of the UK voted for it, and then after the fact, she ended up criticizing the speech as somehow being too accommodative. What do you think of it?
The important thing for us is that the UK voted in favor. They were among the 14th. And today, in the speech of the UK ambassador, he called for the implementation. And we concentrate on these things, not on other things. Yes, ma'am.
Ambassador, are you concerned that the new U.S. Administration, the Trump administration, could move the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem?
We hope that that doesn't happen, because we believe that the position of the United States of America since the creation of the State of Israel, since the time of President Truman, through the presidency of President Barack Obama, that Jerusalem has a special status. They are the ones who drafted Resolution 181 and gave special status to Jerusalem. And they do not agree to the annexation, the unilateral action by Israel to annex East Jerusalem. That is not the position of the United States, nor the position of the Security Council. We sincerely hope that they stay with that position, and they support the Oslo agreements. They were signed on the lawn of the White House in Washington, D.C. And one of the derivatives of the Oslo agreement, it says negotiation on the final status issues, including Jerusalem. And I don't think that that the United States of America, we hope, will honor and respect this tradition, including with regard to Jerusalem, and not to take this step of which would be very offensive and would be very provocative to move the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. We sincerely hope they do not take that step and allow peace to take place and negotiation to take place, including on the issue of Jerusalem. The last, yes, ma'am.
Have you or your office or a Palestinian representative in the U.S. been in touch with the Trump team? And if so, when, how?
My office, no, because that is not our business. We are waiting for the new PR of the United States, and I will be looking forward, you know, to meet with her. She would be my colleague, as I have relationship with almost all members, states at the United Nations. I will be looking forward to work with her in a professional way, in a transparent way, and in a hopefully positive way. Thank you very much.
The U.S. relationship with Israel was also brought up at President Obama's final press conference on Wednesday.
Mr. President, you have been criticized and even personally attacked for the UN Security Council resolution that considered Israeli settlements illegal and an obstacle to peace. Mr. Trump promised to move the embassy to Jerusalem. He appointed an ambassador that doesn't believe in a two-state solution. How worried are you about the U.S. leadership in the Arab world and beyond as an honest broker? Will this ignite a third intifada? Will this even protect Israel? And in retrospect, do you think that you should have held Israel more accountable, like President Bush Sr. did with the loan guarantees? Thank you.
I continue to be significantly worried about the Israeli-Palestinian issue. And I'm worried about it both because I think the status quo is unsustainable, that it is dangerous for Israel, that it is bad for Palestinians, it is bad for the region, and it is bad for America's national security. And you know, I came into this office wanting to do everything I could to encourage serious peace talks between Israelis and Palestinians. And we invested a lot of energy, a lot of time, a lot of effort. First year, second year, all the way until last year. Ultimately, what has always been clear is that we cannot force the parties to arrive at peace. What we can do is facilitate, provide a platform, encourage, but we can't force them to do it. But in light of shifts in Israeli politics and Palestinian politics, a rightward drift in Israeli politics, a weakening of President Abbas's ability to move and take risks on behalf of peace in the Palestinian territories, in light of all the dangers that have emerged in the region and the understandable fears that Israelis may have about the chaos and rise of groups like ISIL and the deterioration of Syria. In light of all those things, what we at least wanted to do, understanding that the two parties wouldn't actually arrive at a final status agreement, is to preserve the possibility of a two-state solution because we do not see an alternative to it. And I've said this directly to Prime Minister Netanyahu. I've said it inside of Israel. I've said it to Palestinians as well. I don't see how this issue gets resolved in a way that maintains Israel as both Jewish and a democracy. Because if you do not have two states, then in some form or fashion you are extending an occupation. Functionally, you end up having one state in which millions of people are disenfranchised and operate as second-class occupants or residents. You can't even call them citizens necessarily. And so the goal of the resolution was to simply say that the settlements, the growth of the settlements, are creating a reality on the ground that increasingly will make a two-state solution impossible. And we've believed, consistent with the position that had been taken with previous U.S. administrations for decades now, that it was important for us to send a signal, a wake-up call, that this moment may be passing. And Israeli voters and Palestinians need to understand that this moment may be passing. And hopefully that then creates a debate inside both Israeli and Palestinian communities that won't result immediately in peace, but at least will lead to a more sober assessment of what the alternatives are. The president-elect will have his own policy. The ambassador or the candidate for the ambassadorship obviously has very different views than I do. That is their prerogative. That's part of what happens after elections. And I think my views are clear. We'll see how their approach plays itself out. I don't want to project today what could end up happening, but obviously it's a volatile environment. What we've seen in the past is when sudden unilateral moves are made that speak to some of the core issues and sensitivities of either side, that can be explosive. What we've tried to do in the transition is just to provide the context in which the president-elect may want to make some of these decisions.
The ownership by 8 individuals of as much wealth as half the world's population presents an existential crisis for humanity. So says BlackAgendaReport.com's Glenn Ford.
The world is being strangled, smothered, and starved to death by billionaires. 1,826 of them by Forbes magazine's count. The ever-deepening concentration of wealth that is both the logic and the inevitable result of capitalism has reached such depraved proportions that 8 of the richest people on the planet now own as much wealth as the bottom half of the entire human race. The very existence of such concentrated private wealth is a crime against humanity and incompatible with any notion of civilization. Indeed, how can a society call itself civilized when half the value of all humanity's labor, which is what those fortunes actually represent, is at the disposal of just 8 men? Clearly, the world needs a revolution to throw off the dead weight of these billionaires. Last year, the Oxfam organization calculated that it took 62 of the world's richest people to equal the wealth held by the bottom half of humanity. This year, it takes only 8. According to Oxfam's latest study, the way capitalism is going, in 25 years, we could be talking about a few trillionaires controlling the wealth of planet Earth. However, I doubt that we'll ever see an age of trillionaires, if only because global society would shatter and explode from the sheer magnitude of the accumulated theft of human labor and natural resources. The billionaires must be made extinct one way or the other, so that the multitudes can restructure the world into a survivable place. The 500 richest people on the planet cannot be allowed 20 years from now to pass on $2.1 trillion in inheritance to their privileged children, the equivalent of the entire yearly economy of India and its 1.3 billion people. The United States has by far the highest concentration of billionaires, 536, followed by China with 251. Russia is way down in 6th place with only 77 billionaires, behind Britain, Germany, and India. But of course, billionaires live anywhere they want to, which really means they live nowhere at all. Home is where their money is, and every billionaire is a fully globalized citizen with no loyalties except to his class. The existence of billionaires should be seen as a measure of the sickness of the capitalist system, now in its last stages. Of the 8 richest billionaires of the United States, 6 made their fortunes from the telecommunications industry, whose political influence now rivals that of Wall Street. Not only are the Silicon Valley fat cats obscenely wealthy, but they control the information systems that the rest of us depend on to understand what's going on in our world. That makes people like Bill Gates, Jeff Bezos, and Mark Zuckerberg very dangerous. The good news is, young people around the world understand the nature of the threat to human freedom that is posed by these information system tycoons, who got rich through monopoly and market manipulation, just like other capitalists. They, too, must face expropriation so that the saga of human equality can begin. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.